Okay, here we go. Stand by. 3, 2, 1, action.
Assume nothing.
Rash, bald-faced blasphemy.
Question everything.
I find it extremely hard to imagine.
Open your eyes.
It is quite all right to be an atheist.
The fastest growing group of people in the country has been measured as being those who have no belief or who are atheists.
You don't have to be apologetic or quiet about it.
Challenge the opposition.
You see religion on 100 fronts losing the argument.
And start thinking. This is The Thinking Atheist Worldwide.
I know summer is over, but next week's broadcast is going to be about summer camp. Specifically, in some ways, we're going to talk about religious summer camp, and some of us have some experience with this. You're supposed to go and be a kid and have fun and make memories and make friends and blah, blah, blah. And many of these summer camps are put on by churches and religious organizations for the purpose of indoctrinating kids, and it ends up being church. Falls Creek is a huge Christian summer camp in Oklahoma. Church 3 times a day. I mean, you get up, you go to church. First thing in the morning, there's a service. There's a service in the middle of the day, and there's another service at night. And trust me, there's an altar call at just about every damn one of them. So we're going to talk about that, some of the insanity that goes on there, and we're going to highlight an alternative to some of this insanity, a wonderful organization called Camp Quest. And so that's coming up next Tuesday. Following that, Aaron Ross is going to join me at the end of September to talk about the foundational falsehoods of creationism, which is coming out in a book. And then Buddhism is a topic we'll cover the first part of October. If you have an opinion, a perspective, if you want to share your voice on any of these issues, the email address to do so is podcast@thethinkingatheist.com. Tonight's show revolves around a new book written by a guy named John C. Wathey. It's called The Illusion of God's Presence, The Biological Origins of Spiritual Longing. Are we hardwired to believe in God? We're going to talk to the author and talk more about this subject here in just a second. First, I'd like to thank our show sponsor today. It's The Great Courses Plus. Unlimited video learning with some of the world's greatest professors just streamed right into your life. Maybe you're like me. I want to be a sponge. I want to learn new stuff every day, to discover things, to know more tomorrow than I know today. With the Great Courses Plus, your home, your office, your smartphone can become your classroom on a huge host of subjects, everything from astronomy to computer programming, how to have a better memory, fitness, nutrition, photography. I'd mentioned that I had just finished the Neil deGrasse Tyson course called The Inexplicable Universe, Unsolved Mysteries. It was amazing. I started watching on my studio computer here. I was out running some errands, had some time to kill. I actually watched some more of that course by just pulling it up on my smartphone. It was awesome. If you love learning, you will love The Great Courses. For my listeners, The Great Courses Plus is offering a free month of unlimited access to all The Great Courses Plus lectures. 30 days of use, totally free, when you sign up at thegreatcoursesplus.com/Seth Andrews. Start your free month and enjoy this wonderful tool for learning. thegreatcoursesplus.com/Seth Andrews. My conversation on today's show is with an author named John C. Wathey. He goes by Jack. He is a smart guy. He's a computational biologist, and he does a lot of work in areas that would make some of our heads explode. Stuff like evolutionary algorithms, protein folding, the biology of nervous systems. Back in the 90s, John served as a senior application scientist at BioSim Technologies. He founded his own business called Wathey Research back in 1996 and has a lot of scientific research funded by grants from the National Institutes of Health. He is an expert in neurobiology, and he's author of a new book called The Illusion of God's Presence, The Biological Origins of Spiritual Longing. And he joins me here. John Wathey, thanks for being on the show.
Oh, it's an honor. It's my pleasure.
You come highly recommended. I was in conversation with Dr. Daryl Ray, who's a friend and someone who's always talking about, you know, the damage that religion does. And we get into some of the belief in the brain conversations with Daryl. But he was just raving about this book of yours. I do from time to time sort of book-related podcasts. You know, there's a centerpiece that our conversation revolves around, and that's the case today. But I want to start by introducing you properly to our audience. Give me some background, Jack. Sure. Who are you? What do you do?
Well, I was born in the Bible Belt in Charlotte, North Carolina, raised by two Christian parents, one Catholic, the other Presbyterian. And I was brought up mainly in the Presbyterian church. But my dad was also a chemist, and so I was brought up with a lot of interest in science, too. I went off to college at Caltech, got a degree in biology, then went to graduate school in neuroscience. So I was always very heavily interested in science. And it was in high school when science and religion started to clash in my brain. So somewhere around age 16, I decided there was something seriously wrong with the religious worldview. It just did not seem to jive with reality anymore. And by age 16 or 17, I was calling myself an atheist. And like many people who leave religion, for a while I just went through this phase where I could just kind of dismiss it. Okay, this is obviously something false. It's if you have an empirical worldview, if you depend on evidence to decide what's true, it's pretty clear that the religious worldview has to be mistaken. And a lot of people just never go beyond that. They just dismiss it. Okay, I'll move on now. I'll see the world the way it really is. But as someone who went deeper into biology and neuroscience and psychology, I started to wonder when I was a graduate student, well, what was that thing I just came from? Why do people do this to themselves? Where does this come from? Where do these religious ideas and feelings come from? And I started to think of it in terms of ethology, which is a branch of behavioral biology that is mainly concerned with animal behavior and is sort of instinctive behaviors. And I could begin to see where religion might come from in terms of ethology, in terms of something innate in human nature. So that's what got the idea of this book started in my brain long, long ago, 30 years ago or so.
So you would have disagreed then with Stephen Jay Gould's famous line about science and religion being non-overlapping magisteria. You think they're incompatible, science and religion?
Yes, basically I do. I do disagree with Stephen Jay Gould on that point. I think they are two fundamentally different ways of making sense of reality, and they clash. When he said that, he was trying to suggest that religion has sort of a legitimate domain of human morality and wonder and spirituality and stuff like that. But all of those things come from the human mind, and that means they come from the human brain, and the human brain is a product of evolution. So I see all of that stuff as natural phenomenon. Religion and the beliefs that people have about it are something that comes from human nature, and human nature is something that comes from our evolutionary history. So I see all of that as natural, all of that within the province of science. And I think science has a lot more to say about religion than most people realize.
Most people pitching religion say science doesn't apply. It's not natural. It is supernatural. Therefore, it defies all the rules. So if you're going to take a scientific microscope to it, it's not really going to work out. Religion doesn't really fit in that bubble is kind of the argument that I often hear. It's rather convenient, I think, but I'm sure you hear it quite a bit as well.
Yes, yes. And it's funny the way people make that argument. Usually they'll say things like, well, God is beyond the reach of science. God is something that is beyond the physical realm, beyond the universe, supernatural, like you said. And when they're saying things like that, what they really have in mind is a God of deism, a God who created the universe and is distant from it and separate from it and doesn't interact with it. And yet, those very same people, most of them, don't believe in such a God at all, because such a God is pretty much useless. A God like that doesn't answer prayers, doesn't love us, doesn't watch what's going on in our lives, doesn't care about us, isn't really a person. It's just sort of a creative force. So if that's the kind of God you're talking about, a God that's completely detached and is just sort of a thing that got the universe started, sure, that's beyond the reach of science. But that's really not the God that almost anybody believes in. Most people want to believe in a God who is a person, who cares about them, who loves them, who follows the events of their lives, who listens to their prayers and performs miracles. A God like that must interact with the world. And if such a God existed, he would not be, he or she or it, would not be beyond the reach of science, because we would see manifestations of it everywhere. If the Christian God were true and existed, then we would see Christians much healthier than the general population. Their cancers would be miraculously cured. They would have wonderful lives and prosperous lives and so on and so forth. But that's not what we see. That's not the reality we see.
The book that we're centering the conversation around is your latest book. It's called The Illusion of God's Presence, The Biological Origins of Spiritual Longing. And back to the point you were making, you're speaking about kind of a parental God, right? We're the helpless child leaning to the parent to meet our needs.
Yes.
And that has, in your opinion, an evolutionary origin?
Yes, I think so. First of all, I should say that part of the reason I wrote the book is that I think this aspect of religion has been largely overlooked by science, especially the scientists who care about religion and who try to make sense of it.
Now, which aspect is missing specifically?
This infantile longing that characterizes so much of religion, this feeling that God loves us and that if we just cry out in prayer, God will respond and answer our prayers and solve our problems. That's something that you just don't see much of in the scientific literature. I wouldn't say it's been completely ignored. Freud addressed it in his early works. There's a thing called the attachment theory of religion, mostly by psychologist Lee Kirkpatrick, that addresses it. But the bulk of the literature, bulk of the scientific literature on religion is concerned with the social aspects of religion, how it gets us to cooperate, to compete with one another, to form groups, social rituals, all of that stuff. That's what most of the anthropologists and psychologists and cognitive psychologists are concerned with these days. And I just felt that they were overlooking something very important. Almost half of what constitutes religiousness, I think, they've been overlooking.
So when we see the ubiquity of the baby story in various religions, starting with the most obvious, the baby Jesus in the manger, you think baby imagery or infant-related narratives inside religion are, that's a pattern, there's a purpose for that, right?
Yes, yes, definitely, definitely so. The essence of my book, the main thesis of the book, is that humans are born with an innate neural model of their mother. It's sort of a built-in expectation in the brain of a human infant that there exists this other being out there somewhere, just kind of a vague sense of the existence of this loving, powerful, caring being out there. And the thing the infant must do is to reach out and connect with that being emotionally, physically, nutritionally. The infant's life depends on that being. And of course, that being is the infant's mother. And this vague sort of sense that of the existence of this being is hardwired into the human brain. And after birth, it is very quickly filled in and fleshed out with specific information about a real specific person. And yet this circuitry that causes this expectation of the mother's existence, I think, is just so hardwired into the brain that it lingers, it's there throughout adulthood, but normally lies dormant. But under special circumstances, often but not necessarily stressful ones that mimic the helplessness of infancy, this circuitry can be activated. And when it's activated, it triggers this feeling, this compelling illusion that this other being exists and is out there, and you can almost feel its presence at a specific place, like it was something you could reach out and touch. And that, I think, is at the core of this basic feeling of a loving God being out there somewhere.
From your perspective, then, it's nature more than nurture. We're hardwired for this, and we have evolved a tendency to seek out this sort of other, is the only word that really comes to mind, you know.
Yes.
Is that accurate, or am I misrepresenting it?
No, that's fair. But I would say it's both. It's both nature and nurture. They're about equally important. And one of the main new wrinkles in my book is this emphasis on this innate model of the mother. There are many other examples of it in biology, by the way. It's more the rule than the exception that a newborn or a hatchling has some innate knowledge of the world it's born into or hatched into. Sea turtle hatchlings, for example, do not have an innate longing for their mothers because their mother is long gone by the time they hatch out. But what they do have is an innate longing for the ocean. And they have an innate model of what the ocean is and what it looks like. So when they first crawl out of the sand, out of their nest on the beach, they have an innate longing to get to the ocean, and they have this innate model that it's the brightest thing on the horizon. They scan the horizon with their eyes and look for the brightest place on the horizon. And no matter what time of day it is, it's usually at night that they hatch out. But no matter what time of day it is, the brightest thing on the horizon will normally be the ocean because the starlight or moonlight or whatever is glistening off the shimmering water, and that's the glowing thing they need to crawl to. So there are many, many examples like this I talk about in the book of animals that have some kind of innate neural model of what it is they're born into and what they need to do.
But the argument then becomes, well, this is been planted within us as part of a design. We are designed to crave a divine parent, right? Wouldn't this be evidence for God?
Well, some people would say that, but of course, I just say it's a product of evolution. It's human infants who did not have this, who did not have this intense longing for their mothers, would be less likely to survive. Humans practice what's called cooperative breeding. Humans are different from most of our ape cousins in that we reproduce at a much higher rate than other apes. And unlike chimpanzees or gorillas, where the mother will hold the infant exclusively and won't share the infant with other females in the group, human mothers have to do that. Human mothers have to share their infants with other females and solicit the help of grandmothers and aunts and cousins and older siblings, because they're juggling too many babies. They just produce too many babies and have too many other things to do. So we do this cooperative breeding, and it depends on the human infant playing a greater role in the formation of a mother-infant bond. The infants have to be aware of where their mother is, because their mother is their primary caregiver, their primary source of nutrition during the first critical months. So sociobiologist Sarah Hurdy makes this point in several of her books, that human infants are more engaged in forming the mother-infant bond than the infants of other apes. So there's a lot of selective pressure for this. So I would say, yes, it's something that's evolved, and you can easily reason why it would evolve. There are selective pressures for it.
There's a meme, a series of memes I see on the internet that say that all babies are born atheists, right? We are all born without a specific religious belief attached to us. That's usually the product of family and culture.
Yes.
From your perspective, though, do we have an evolved need to believe? Are we really born atheists?
That's a great question. And I take it up in the book in one place. And my answer to it is, I like to put it this way, that we are all born theistically competent, much as we are born linguistically competent, although not to the same extent, because obviously more people use language than are religious. So when I say that we're born linguistically competent, what I mean is that the auditory cortex of a human infant has circuitry that's specialized for the reception of language. There's some fascinating experiments that have been done with this. You can measure evoked potentials from the scalp of a newborn infant while playing phonemes, little syllables from human speech, to the infant. And if you play a single syllable repeatedly, you get these waveforms from the brain. And if in the middle of this sequence of a repeated syllable, you throw in an unexpected one that's only slightly different, a very subtle difference, like the difference between pa and ta, when the unexpected one comes along, if the brain is capable of distinguishing that, making that subtle distinction between those two similar phonemes, you'll get a different waveform. And you can show by doing these experiments that a newborn infant can make these very subtle distinctions, very subtle discriminations between syllables. So they have cortex that is clearly expecting language and is highly specialized for language and can make these very subtle speech-specific discriminations at birth. And in a similar way, I'm suggesting we have a theistically competent cortex that is expecting something godlike, but that something is not God. That godlike something that this part of the brain is expecting is actually mother. It's expecting a relationship with this external savior, the mother. And for various unfortunate reasons, it persists into adulthood and can lead us astray into believing in something truly godlike, truly magical.
Truly in your book, I think you quote from Matthew, you know, truly I tell you, unless you change and become like little children, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven. Even the scriptures in Christianity and many other religions command us, be childlike and depend on your parent or your father for everything you need.
Yes, yes. Religion is dripping with infantile imagery. It's so appealing. It's like I say, it's at the core of these emotions that drive a certain aspect of religiousness, that some of the most successful religions are the ones that appeal to this infantile aspect of religiousness, but that people want to feel like little babies with super parents up in the sky who are looking out for them and taking care of them. And
it's assuring, though, isn't it? I mean, the idea that no matter how chaotic things are, no matter how crazy things get, no matter how nonsensical it is, someone out there is in control. That's assuring for a whole lot of people.
Yes, it is. It's very comforting. And I think it explains some of the time course in people's development of religiousness. Very often, people become more religious sort of in their midlife when their parents die and their parents themselves, maybe, and they're facing a lot of burdens in life. And suddenly, life is a lot more complicated than it used to be back when they were little kids. And it feels comforting to think that, well, maybe I still can be a little kid in a way, and maybe I still do have a parent in a way. Maybe I do have a heavenly father. And gee, that would be nice if that were true. Maybe it is true.
I know much of this it's rather clinical. I mean, it's much of this stuff dealing with belief in the brain and how beliefs and perceptions are formed and filtered. I realize this is not sexy stuff for a whole lot of people, but it's very interesting stuff, I think. And, you know, you talked in your book about agency detection in the human brain, the fact that we tend to assign agency to inanimate things or things we do not understand or specific patterns. Do you want to take a second and talk about how we sort of assign agency to whatever out there?
Sure. This is a very popular idea in the cognitive science of religion. It's been around for a long time. You can see it in the writings of Charles Darwin in, I believe it was The Descent of Man, when he was talking about the evolution of human beings. He talks about the origin of religion in these terms, that we tend to, when we see something complex and hard to understand and hard to explain, we tend to think of it immediately as the product of an intelligence, because we are intelligent and we see ourselves making complex things and tools and houses and things. And so if we see something we have a hard time explaining, like the complexity of nature, it's just easy to assume, well, there must be a mind behind that. Some thinking being must have created that. There's good biological reasons for us to do that. Also, when we're wandering through the jungles or through the savanna and we hear a rustling in the grass, should we assume that it's just the wind blowing, or is it safer to assume that it's a predator that might be about to leap out of the grass and kill us? If you make the latter assumption, that there's an intelligence behind this odd sound you've just heard, and it turns out to be a leopard, then you're more likely to leave offspring for the future generations. And so we're just biased to make that inference that there is some intelligence behind whatever we don't understand.
I'm talking here with Jack Wathy, the author of the book, The Illusion of God's Presence. You talked a little bit in the book about the deconversion of your wife, right? She looked around thinking there may be agency, thinking there was a God, but for her, it was the problem of evil. or the argument from meaningless suffering.
Yes.
That caused her to reassess and say, hey, wait a minute, this doesn't look like a divine plan to me. And this is probably a common story, yeah?
Yeah, I think so. Hers was, she also lost her religious belief at about the same age I did, at around age 16. She was visiting friends of her family who lived in Switzerland. And just by coincidence, when she arrived there, she arrived just a day or two after their newborn infant had died of sudden infant death syndrome. So she walked into this terrible situation where the parents were utterly devastated by this. And she just it was the first time she had seen anything up close and personal that was that tragic, that painful. And her visceral reaction to it was, there cannot be a loving God if this kind of thing happens. A loving God would not allow this to happen.
When the Dan Barker who said, all you have to do is visit a children's hospital, and you know there is no, at least no benevolent God.
Yes. Yeah. It's a very powerful argument for some people. Not everyone. Some people manage to rationalize their way through anything. But
well, it's probably a coping mechanism for mom and dad, the idea that one day they will all be reunited. That's a powerful illusion, for sure.
Yes. Yes, very much so. Yes.
Are we getting some kind of a drug hit? I mean, is our brain giving us a pleasure boost when we believe in superstitious things? I mean, do people genuinely get high on God? Have you gone into this at all?
A little bit, yes. More so in my second book, which is still in progress, than in the first one. But I briefly mentioned it in, I think it's chapter 13, in The Illusion of God's Presence.
Well, you say in the book, God's presence is a drug-free hallucination. But I was thinking to myself, well, is the mind producing the drug, the chemical boost for you?
Yes. I think there's something to that. There's a part of the brain that's involved in reinforcement learning called the nucleus accumbens. It's part of the reward pathway, and it's this sort of the epicenter of drug addiction. It's the part of the brain where most addictive drugs exert their effects by increasing the concentration of dopamine. And I have reason to think that that's probably also involved in a lot of religious experiences, especially the intense longing for this mystical other. The evidence is kind of indirect at the moment. I don't think it's been adequately studied, but in the book, the evidence that I draw on has to do with the behavior of rat pups, newly born rats. They have an interesting behavior where if they're rat pups, by the way, are completely helpless like human infants. They have to be looked after by their mothers. And if they get separated from their mother, if they get knocked out of the nest or whatever, they'll start crying in ultrasonic cries to summon the help of their mother. And if you separate a rat pup from the nest, it will start crying like this. And if you briefly put the mother in with the separated rat just for a minute or so, it will calm down because it senses the mother's presence. And then you take the mother away again and leave the infant pup alone, it will start crying again, but now at about double or triple the normal rate, the rate at which it had been crying before. So it's as if having a brief sensation of the mother's presence gets the infant's longing for the mother boosted. It gets it amplified. So now the infant is crying even more than it was when it was first taken out of the nest. And if you look, because now we're talking about rats and not humans, you can do experiments with rats that you cannot do with humans, like injecting things into the brain and so on. And when you do experiments with these rat pups, you find that the part of the brain that's critical for this behavior, this acceleration of the crying in response to the mother's presence, that is the nucleus accumbens. That is the epicenter of drug addiction. So it's almost like the rat pup is responding to the mother's presence as if it were a cocaine dealer about to give them a hit. It's something they're longing for the way a drug addict longs for the drug. So in that sense, the attachment between infant and mother is a very powerful, almost addictive-like attachment. And I think the attachment between believer and God may be an addictive-like attachment.
So the next question then becomes, what's the harm? You know, come on, it alleviates my fears. It calms me. It soothes me. It gives me a sense of purpose. I get a hit. I feel pleasure. What's the problem if I want to believe in God?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think for many people, it's not only harmless, relatively harmless, it may even be beneficial. I've met people who have had very hard times in life. I've met people who have suffered a great deal. And the feeling that there exists this loving God who's taking care of them and looking out for them gives them so much comfort and stability that it really makes it possible for them to get through life, whereas without it, they might not be able to. And for people like that, I have no problem with them being religious or spiritual. I think it may be a good thing and a necessary and a helpful thing. So
the problem, though, is when it results in something actionable. I mean, normally this belief doesn't exist in a bubble. They have offspring of their own. Then they download this sort of magical thinking to their kids.
Yes.
Or, you know, they participate in the world using sort of their God glasses, seeing everything through a God filter. Then it becomes a disconnect from reality. That is a problem.
Yes, exactly. And that was going to be my next thought, that this kind of therapeutic aspect of religiousness or spirituality is fine as long as you don't try to force it on anybody else. The problem is that most people who are religious do end up forcing it on someone else, almost always their own children, if they have children.
Yeah, religion is propagating, right? It only survives if it's, I don't know, do you call religion a virus, the God virus, like Dr. Daryl Ray does? Or?
Yes, I talk about that a little bit in my chapter 3, and I think that's a legitimate way to think of it. It does sort of propagate mind to mind. It has that quality to it. I think that's a legitimate and useful way to think about it.
Jack, since you're plugged into neuroscience and this is one of your interests, have you followed the God helmet? It's been around for years and years, the work of Michael Persinger, the neuroscientist, and this helmet that they put on their heads, the heads of a subject, and stimulate parts of the brain, I guess using magnets. I mean, have you dipped your toe into these waters? What do you think?
I have. And again, that's something I talk about in my second book. But I'm very skeptical of Persinger's work. He's an interesting guy. He's a little eccentric. And the main thing, though, that makes me skeptical of him is that someone else, another group in Sweden, tried to replicate his results. And they collaborated with him. They tried to duplicate his equipment and settings and tried to make their setup the same as his as closely as they could. And what they found was that the magnetic fields had no influence whatsoever on whether a person reported a sensed presence in this isolation chamber where they have the subjects. People did report having sensed presence experiences, but the only factor that correlated with that was the suggestibility of the subjects, not whether or not the magnetic fields were on.
So this is reporting by the subject a subjective verbal account of what they think they feel. This isn't a hard measurement of the brain itself.
That's correct. That's correct.
So essentially, it's just eyewitness testimony is what they're having to go with.
Yeah, pretty much so. And that's pretty much what Persinger has to go with, too, except that he claims that when he flicks the switch and turns on these magnetic fields, that it increases the probability of these experiences. But a separate study failed to replicate that. And another point that should be made is that his method of inducing magnetic fields into the brain is very different from what most neuroscientists use who do magnetic stimulation. It's about a millionfold weaker than the magnetic field strength necessary to induce a visual spot, a visual illusion in visual cortex, or muscle twitching in motor cortex. So that raises some alarm bells. It's a very unconventional, very weak magnetic stimulation.
I used to invoke the God helmet story a lot more when I first got into, you know, the movement, when I was first speaking out against the subjective nature of belief and how we each have our own gods and they often look like us kind of thing, you know. And but the more I began to see the criticisms and the skepticism of, well, no one else can really replicate this, and it's not necessarily being accurately measured. I don't really do it anymore, but I am fascinated by the idea of having parts of the brain stimulated with magnets and sensing a presence in the room. I mean, it is fascinating stuff, for sure.
Yeah, yes, very much so. And I don't dismiss it in principle. It's entirely possible that it could be made to work. I'm just not sure that Persinger has accomplished that.
What do you want to accomplish with the book? I mean, what is it? Are you trying to speak to Christians to reveal to them that your brain may be tricking you? There's even a section of the book called Trick of the Mind. I mean, is this the end zone, or is it for the general population? I mean, who are you going for?
I'm definitely trying to reach a general readership. The book is not written for academics, although I've tried to write it to a very high standard of scientific scholarship. And if any academics want that aspect of it, if they want to see the scientific literature that's behind my ideas, I push all that into the end notes. So it's there.
I mean, it's something the layperson can really get into, but it's a thick little number you got here.
It's
not
book.
A light read, you know what I'm saying?
Yes, yes. It's kind of a thick book, but it's only 300 pages of the main text. It's got a lot of endnotes and references, like I said, for the academics, but the normal people don't have to read that. I've tried very hard to write it in a way that's reader-friendly and fairly jargon-free, and where I have to use technical terms, I try to explain them and define them. But the people I had in mind when I was writing the book are mainly people like me who got out of religion, who were separated from it and could see it as false, but were still puzzled by it. What is it that makes us do this? Where does this come from? Why do humans do this to themselves? But also, I wanted to reach believers who are wrestling with doubt. I'm very empathetic towards people like that because I was in that situation myself once, and I appreciate that people who are committed believers are very hard to reach, that humans are very skillful at rationalizing almost anything to fit their preconceived notions and their beliefs. But once that starts to break down, once you've had the experience like my wife had with seeing the sudden infant death syndrome, or had some prayer that should have been answered that was not answered, some terrible cancer or other disaster in the family, when your worldview is shaken and you begin to face the possibility that, okay, maybe this isn't true, then you need help. Then I think you could use a little help, and I've tried to provide that to people who are wrestling with that kind of situation.
This is a movement so often, I think, in need of empathy. We have the data, we have facts, we have evidence, we have all this ammunition that we bring, but so often we just forget to bring empathy and compassion into the discussions. I've seen many people assert outright religious people aren't just victims of bad ideas, that they are operating with damaged brains. They're brain-damaged people. And of course, I was once a believer myself. I resist the idea that, I was brain damaged. I was a victim of bad ideas. And so you're not talking about a defective mind. You're talking about natural workings of the brain fueled by environmental concerns.
Yes. And in fact, I'm glad you brought that up because I have struggled very hard to find a good title for this book. And I've had lots of criticism and praise for the title and it ultimately settled on. Some people tell me it sounds too much like Richard Dawkins' The God Delusion. But I specifically chose the word illusion rather than delusion because delusion suggests exactly what you were just talking about, a defective brain, some schizophrenia or something. And I strongly disagree with that. You can find schizophrenics who have religious delusions, but most people who are religious are not that. They're people with normal, healthy brains who are experiencing an illusion, not a delusion. And I talk about a thing called cognitive impenetrability, which is an aspect of many, many kinds of illusions, not just a religious one, but sensory illusions like the Ames room, where you see this, what looks like a normal rectangular room with two people standing in the distant corners, and they can be identical twins, and one of them is half the size of the other. And if they walk across the room and change places, you can see them shrinking and growing as they change places. So if you see this illusion, and even if you know how it works, you completely understand the illusion, even if you built the room yourself with your own two hands, you still see the illusion. And this is what psychologists call cognitive impenetrability. Our conscious understanding of the workings of the illusion are not enough to penetrate the illusion. So I think this illusion of God's presence is that kind of illusion. It's cognitively impenetrable. And once you've experienced it, it's very hard to see it as anything other than real evidence for the existence of this mystical godlike being.
There's a show I enjoy on Netflix. It's called Brain Games, where they talk about perception and the brain and memory and how easily we are fooled. And I'll tell you, after watching a dozen or so episodes of Brain Games, I just look around and think, you know, perception isn't reality necessarily. Yes. Yes. We are easily fooled. I mean, our brains are hugely useful, certainly. But those who know how to manipulate the system, certainly those who are pitching some sort of woo, or, you know, you can see other mysticists and the prophet preachers and those who know how to manipulate the eager and the vulnerable and the gullible. You can see how they can manipulate perception to sell reality, quote unquote reality.
Oh yes, yes, very much so. The human brain takes a lot of shortcuts to make sense of reality, to interpret the world around us. And if you know what those shortcuts are, you can trick the brain very easily.
And if you know that someone's trying to trick the brain, perhaps you can reason your way past. And how do I even phrase that, Jack? If you're aware then that these tricks exist, perhaps it's a preventative measure to keep yourself from being duped.
Yes, I think so. And it's not just sensory illusions that are involved here. We have a tendency as human beings to decide what's true or false based on intuitive feelings. That's kind of the natural mode we work in. We depend on intuitions a lot to make decisions. What foods are appealing, what foods are safe, what foods are not, what people we should choose as friends and whom we should marry. Those very complex decisions are so complex, so many factors go into them, that we can't really reason our way to a decision. And very often, when we're trying to make a decision like that, an answer will just come to us, and we'll suddenly wake up one morning and say, oh yes, this woman, Sally, that I've been dating, she's the one, I'm going to marry her, I just know this is going to work, and this is going to be right. And very often, it works out. That kind of decision-making based on intuition comes from the unconscious mind. We have a whole lot of stuff going on below consciousness that we're not aware of, where all kinds of things and factors are being weighed and compared, and we just get this emotional feeling that wells up into consciousness. It gives us a decision. And that works for a lot of what we have to do to survive. But the whole point of intuition is just that. It's survival and reproductive success. That's what it's aimed at. It is not aimed at optimal truth finding. So if you start using intuition for truth finding to try to understand how reality really works, you're likely to be led astray. And so if you just are aware of that, if you know about human intuition and you know that these feelings that come to us intuitively are there for reproductive success and not for truth finding, if you're just aware of that much, then you're way ahead, because then you can start deliberately ignoring your intuitions when it comes to matters of fact and matters of truth.
John C. Wathy, author of the book, The Illusion of God's Presence. I will include a link to this book in the description box of this broadcast, or you can just find it on Amazon. Or is there another website where people can find you and your work, sir?
Yes, wathyresearch.com is the website I have set up for the book. There's a lot of interesting little stuff in there, some overview and discussion, and links to where you can buy the book.
That's W-A-T-H-E-Y, wathyresearch.com?
That's it.
thank you so much for your time and for having this discussion. I think it's really interesting stuff, understanding how belief and the brain sort of tie together, and we'll turn everybody onto the book, and all success with it, my friend.
Thank you so much, Seth. I really enjoyed this.
Follow The Thinking Atheist on Facebook and Twitter. Watch dozens of original videos on The Thinking Atheist YouTube channel. And visit our website for resources, links, contact information, the editor's blog, and more. TheThinkingAtheist.com.